Kennedy and Dr. King came up during the years of the Great Depression. And while our union was founded here in Detroit, just 6 years after Dr. King's birth, many of you may not know, our first sit-down strike, it wasn't in Flint, but a month prior to the Flint strike, it was at a Fisher Body Plant near Atlanta, Georgia, the home of Dr. King. When I look at these things, I can't help but see the parallels between the story of Dr. King and the story of the United Auto Workers. Throughout my walk as a union rep, I've always found a lot of inspiration from Dr. King, his teachings and his words. You know, the fact is, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is one of the greatest labor leaders in our country's history.
Welcome, welcome. Left Reckoning 153. My name is David Griscom. I'm broadcasting to y'all live from Austin, Texas. Joined as always by my good friend and comrade, Mr. Matt Leck. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing well, David. Good to be with you in this 2024.
Yeah.
Even though we're doing a show, it feels,
It does feel like we're back in the saddle again. I mean, we got a big one for everybody today. In a little bit, we're going to be joined by Marion Williamson. She joined us to talk a little bit about her campaign, what's going on in Gaza, and about the Democratic Party and this whole process within the Democratic Party primary, which has been, I'll opine here a little bit. not really up to snuff in terms of pursuing any kind of internal democracy, at least in the party, let alone in the country. But more on that later. In the post game, Matt and I are going to be hanging out, talking and reacting to that Marianne conversation, as well as taking y'all's calls and questions. You can get access to that patreon.com/leftreckoning. I did want to say something just really quick on that opening clip there, Matt, because I think Matt McManus made an interesting point on Twitter the other day about how it's pretty noticeable how the right wing has gone from, for a while they were trying to sort of whitewash MLK and be like, oh, MLK would have been a conservative Republican today. People probably saw Charlie Kirk and a few other people on the far right were sort of attacking and reverting more to an OG position on the American right. And I won't tell you exactly what I think that means, but I don't think it portends very well for the state of politics in the United States.
Yeah. I mean, you could do the optimistic take, which is that it's just reality breaking through. MLK is not sort of like this guy who could be easily grouped in with centrist moderates and even like Republicans basically use him as a opportunity to diminish any sort of issues of racism in this country. MLK was very interesting and also like engaged in these sorts of politics. It wasn't just like the I have a dream and I'm also like a religious type of guy. He was a little bit more savvy. And I can't remember which biography I was reading of his, but it was dealing with, I believe, his father. And talking about how, like, yeah, actually, these church leaders are too preoccupied with pie in the sky stuff and need to deal with economics a little bit, which is, and poverty. That's the optimistic take. And, the bad take is, they're reverting to, Jim Crow.
Oh, Lord. It seems like we lost Matt there pretty abruptly. Hopefully he'll get back on in just a second. But... there we are.
Sorry about that. And in my back, yeah. And reverting to Jim Crow type of racism and race realism. So, yeah, I saw the Charlie Kirk thing. Wired magazine did an article about how, years ago he had been doing the We Love MLK. He's a model for how, like, you go work hard for a businessman and you can accomplish anything in this country. And now, he was basically a Marxist.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as much as the kind of rebranding, conservative rebranding of figures like that was annoying, I think that says something when these folks don't even feel the need to try to speak to some of those traditions. But I mean, we're going to talk about another pretty nasty American tradition in just a second in regards to Gaza. But before we get there, I did just want to do like a quick shout out and update for folks. We'll definitely do more on this. But people might remember it a little while ago, we did an episode on Guatemala. And there's some good news there. We were talking about the attempts by the right and the ruling class in Guatemala to try to overturn the election. And we used the word coup then. And luckily, and this is very recent, Bernardo Arevalo was able to become the president of Guatemala, despite an attempt from the right to try to prevent him from standing and taking that position. So we'll definitely do a quick, we'll definitely do a more in-depth update on that in the near future. But wanted to start off with some good news because we're about to talk about some really difficult stuff today.
Yeah, good news, but also another instance of the handoff of power being kind of iffy and a bit concerning for a little bit there. And yeah, that's not exactly something you like to see in world politics. But yeah, definitely good news. Arevalo is at least going to get the opportunity to govern.
Well, Matt, I think you know we can get into this a little bit. We got a few clips to take y'all through. We're going to talk a little bit about the ICJ case that was brought forward by South Africa in regards to the mass slaughter campaign that Israel has been engaged in Gaza. And I think it's really important to note for a few reasons. One, because of the clear humanitarian importance and need for there to be a ceasefire, but also because it does seem to represent countries outside of, let's say, like the United States' direct influence, starting to find ways to influence international and global politics, right? Trying to find ways outside of the direct spheres of control of the United States and countries like the United Kingdom, and building up this bloc that is saying no to the mass slaughter campaign in Israel. And, you know, we can be a little cynical and understandably so about the kind of international human rights community, right? Because we've seen time and time again, particularly because of the American influence. But the difficulty in actually being able to utilize those forums to prevent mass atrocities like we're seeing right now in Gaza. But it's a really important step, I think. And the arguments that were made by South Africa, I found to be very, very compelling. You know, and just to be clear, people should go and check out and try to watch as much of them as possible. This was, you know, the clips that we have here from the United Nations live stream of the proceedings, which is about 3 hours. You know, so there's a lot in there. But it's something that I think is, you know, really important for us on this program specifically to be broadcasting, because in American media, there was one group of people who were heard, and that was Israel's defense, while the South African claims and proceedings were hidden and sort of written about on the back page of the newspapers. So we wanted to make sure that we're giving some space to these, because they lay out not only the extent of the attack in Gaza, but also breaking down the language that they are that the Israeli government has been using, and is very clearly being used to inspire soldiers in engaging in these kinds of atrocities. So why don't we play this first clip here, sort of outlining the case in broad sweeps.
It's my task to address the court on the genocidal acts that have led to this urgent request for provisional measures under Article 41 of the Statute of the Court. South Africa contends that Israel has transgressed Article 2 of the Convention by committing actions that fall within the definition of genocide. The actions show a systematic pattern of conduct from which genocide can be inferred. Allow me to place these acts in context. Gaza is one of the two constituent territories of the occupied Palestinian territories, occupied by Israel since 1967. It is a narrow strip of approximately 365 square kilometers, as depicted in the map now displayed. Israel continues to exercise control over the space, territorial waters, land crossings, water, electricity, electromagnetic sphere, and civilian infrastructure in Gaza, as well as over key governmental functions. As the Honourable Minister has said, entry and exit by air and sea to Gaza is prohibited, with Israel operating the only two crossing points. Gaza, which is one of the most densely populated places in the world, is home to approximately 2.3 million Palestinians, almost half of them children. For the past 96 days, Israel has subjected Gaza to what has been described as one of the heaviest conventional bombing campaigns in the history of modern warfare. Palestinians in Gaza are being killed by Israeli weaponry and bombs from air, land, and sea. They are also at immediate risk of death by starvation, dehydration, and disease as a result of the ongoing siege by Israel, the destruction of Palestinian towns, the insufficient aid being allowed through to the Palestinian population, and the impossibility of distributing this limited aid while bombs fall.
And, you know, there's a few things that are obviously very, you know, important there. First and foremost, obviously, the kind of outlining of the mass bombing campaign, and then the knockdown effects of that, which is like the lack of aid, the lack of food, the lack of water. But two, she knows something that I think is really critical, because it's something that you hear from apologists for the Israeli occupation, for the mass slaughter of Palestinians, is that, oh, well, Israel doesn't control Gaza. Israel doesn't control Gaza. Well, what sovereign nation in the world doesn't control its own borders, can't control its own trade, can't control its own airspace? You know, it's ludicrous at this point to make that argument, as we're all seeing what's going on. But that has always been an argument that you've gotten from the far right about what's going on in Gaza. And I think making this point is that, like, no, this is like a deliberate program. Not just of the mass slaughter campaign that we're seeing now, but before that, the blockade, the prevention of Palestinians to have free movement, you know, has all played into this really horrifying situation that we're all viewing now. But something that's been going on for a really, really long time, and, you know, something that's just been amazing to me to watch the ignorant ways that a lot of American commentators will speak about this issue.
Yeah, well, this is really like ultimately where you can start the genocide conversation, which is like like you say, a type of a people that is severed off in whether which side of which border they're on, which territory, how much freedom they have, their ability to you know, visit people in other situations is completely controlled by the Israeli government. And that stops a people from being able to reproduce itself. And that's where you start talking about genocide. And this whole period since October 7th is war crime after war crime after war crime toward that end. And, you know, genocide, like the thing is like what's happening now is one, I think, extremely, it's nice to see people in these institutions taking this seriously, because this is a major test. This is a test of whether the word genocide means something that it's a word that can be relied upon to point toward a specific event that we want to not see happen on the world, or is it a word that's deployed by powerful people when it's time to use the military, whether it's in Kosovo or Ukraine or China, right? And like that, I guess like that is where this is a major test we're looking on for the world. And it's in a way it's bigger than even Palestinians. This is what kind of world we have, what kind of world order, exists. And it's, you know, the stakes couldn't be higher. I think the case itself is, in my opinion, unimpeachable. And certainly not impeached by the Israeli defense.
Well, I mean, we have a little bit more stuff that I find to be really damning. And like, again, you know, we had to pick, clips from this longer, presentation, and the ones that we're going to play in a second are very much about the way that the government has been sort of encouraging the atrocities in Gaza. And, you know, on this program, if you've been watching us, over since October 7th, we have broken down a lot of these attacks on civilians. This really gets into the second level stuff, right? Which is like, yes, 24,000 Palestinians dead, right? These are the numbers that have been being brought up by South Africa. The vast majority of those being women and children. It's absolutely clear what's going on. But when you have government officials, as we're going to play in just a second, saying what they're saying, using the kind of language that they're using, the Israeli defense, and the Israeli defense, I'll sum it up very briefly for y'all. It's, we're doing a military thing, a military campaign, and gosh darn it, it's really hard for us to control where our bombs fall. That's basically what their presentation amounted to. And that's the one that got a lot of play in American media, so we thought it was really important to make sure that the South African presentation was being brought up. So we're going to play a little bit longer clip here in a second, breaking down some of the statements coming from the Israeli military, how that is being reacted to by people, by officials in the Israeli government, how that is playing out with members of the Israeli military. But before we get there, just to sort of catch people up so that they can follow and understand what these proceedings are about, what is being asked for here, what are the possibilities here? What is happening right now is before the ICJ, these presentations have been made by South Africa and by Israel. A genocide case will take years to go through, right? And understandably so. It's a high standard. You need to allow for justice and these presentations to happen, right? A proper investigation. But what is so important and is absolutely critical right now is that South Africa is asking for a provisional ruling that would basically call on Israel to implement a ceasefire. And whether or not Israel would play ball is very unlikely. As we've seen anything, the Biden administration's bear hug of Netanyahu and the Israeli government has shown that that the United States is willing to sort of buck the international community in defense of Israel and allowing Israel to continue this mass slaughter campaign against Gazans. But getting this provisional ruling would be a massive thing in sort of trying to reorient the global community around justice for Palestinian people, around human rights. So the hope here is that the ICJ makes this provisional ruling. That's something that could happen within the next few weeks, while the larger genocide case would take years to play out. So we're going to be watching that, but I just want people to understand the context of what is actually happening here. But let's play this bit here. It's a longer clip, but some of the evidence of statements from the Israeli government and how that is sort of playing out in the military theater.
It is no answer to say that neither are in command of the army. They are ministers in the Israeli government. They vote in the Knesset and are in a position to shape state policy. The intent to destroy Gaza has been nurtured at the highest levels of state, as President Isaac Herzog has joined the ranks of those signing bombs destined for Gaza. Having previously noted that the entire population in Gaza is responsible and that this rhetoric about civilians not aware, not involved, is absolutely not true, we will fight until we break their backbone. Later attempts by the president and others to neutralize this speech have not altered the sting of his words, which was to tar all Palestinians as responsible for the actions of Hamas. Nor, as I will show below, has it affected how state policy is understood within government. The Minister of National Security repeated the President's statements that Hamas and civilians are responsible in equal measure. On 10 November 2023, in a televised interview, he stated that when we say that Hamas should be destroyed, it also means those who celebrate, those who support, and those who hand out candy. They are all terrorists, and they should also be destroyed. These are orders to destroy and to maim what cannot be destroyed. These statements are not open to neutral interpretations or after-the-fact rationalizations and reinterpretations by Israel. The statements were made by persons in command of the state. They communicated state policy. It is simple. If the statements were not intended, they would not have been made. The genocidal intent behind these statements is not ambiguous to the Israeli soldiers on the ground. Indeed, it is directing their actions and objectives. On 7 December 2023, Israeli soldiers proved that they understood the Prime Minister's message to remember what the Amalek has done to you as genocidal. They were recorded by journalists dancing and singing. We know our motto, there are no uninvolved, that they obey one commandment to wipe off the seed of Amalek. The Prime Minister's invocation of Amalek is being used by soldiers to justify the killing of civilians, including children. These are the soldiers repeating the inciting words of their Prime Minister.
Just pause it there to read the translation for that last little part. We know our slogan, there are no uninvolved civilians. And yeah, I think we can, this just plays the rest of this video here, David.
Yeah, no. And I mean, I think that that's, you know, that that is something that, because, you know, this invocation of Amalek, that we've seen from figures within the Israeli government. I mean, this is extremely, extremely clear rhetoric. Because when they're talking about this, they are talking about the biblical story of wiping out an entire people, right? This is not unmistakable. This is purposeful. This is something that the Israeli right has invoked time and time again. And now you are seeing the soldiers very clearly hearing the message from their government about what it is that their implied orders are, right? Both on the biblical claim, right? But two, when you say there are no uninvolved civilians, I mean, what does that mean? It means every human being, every woman and child in Gaza is a combatant, right? That is genocidal language. That is language of eradication. And look, they can put whatever cute spin they want on it after, you know, they get in trouble from the media. It's very clear when you see Israeli soldiers dancing and singing that, that they understand their commands very clearly, not just in the sense of what it is that they're sort of being instructed to do, but the confidence that that gives you that there are no repercussions, that there is nothing that is going to get you into trouble with your own government. And that's why it is damn important that the people of South Africa and many other countries have stood up and taken this position that they have. You know, we'll talk about it a little bit more in depth in a second, but it's extremely notable, as I'm sure everybody watching this program knows, that South Africa is playing this role here. This is a country that is invoked constantly in relation to Israel, because South Africa is a country, you know, that had a system of racial separation, of racial brutality, literally the word apartheid, that is used to accurately describe Israel, has its origins there. I mean, I don't know how
the plan for like how Israelis see, the end game is basically Bantustans, which is like, we'll give you little pockets where you are supposedly in charge within limits. And we're going to like create our society in increasingly surrounding those.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there anything else you can say there other than the fact that the case that was brought forward from South Africa was, as you said, Matt, unimpeachable. And, you know, they literally, you know, broke down, by the way, too. The attacks by Hamas are condemnable and also violations of human rights. You know, this was not some kind of flippant, you know, presentation by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, it was one that was extremely tedious and careful to be as accurate as possible. And, you know, one can only hope that these, you know, international systems of human rights are able to live up to their task. I hate to say that I am, frankly, very pessimistic, knowing the history of the United Nations and these institutions in general. But it's a very damn important thing, and it's something that's worth us covering on this program and people making sure, you know, is put into the record, because a lot of work is being done right now to sort of prevent people from interacting with the stuff in the first place.
I hope to be surprised pleasantly. Same. Because, you know, you play that video or they play that video into evidence, actually. And to contrast this, and I will warn people, this next imagery is as horrific as anything I've seen since I've professionally been doing this. Hundreds of thousands of people are on the brink of starvation on a famine imposed on the population of Gaza by Israel. Collectively, and here is those people running down the beach after word that there are food trucks down there. There's all this discussion of the death toll, and you know, who knows where is that 20,000 It could get a lot worse. Mm-hmm. And right in front of our eyes, right as we're, you know, messing around with, you know, all this, you know, crap of like, you know, is the left too supportive of the Houthis? You have, you know, people, hundreds of thousands of people on the brink of starvation. And it's like, we know, I don't know. It's like, it puts anything else, you know, growing up, like looking at Guernica as like an example of like, let's never repeat this history. It's like, we're putting all that to shame in 4K.
No. And it's horrifying. And any people who are talking out both sides of their mouth and saying, oh, well, you know, Israel's now saying that they're going to slow down the operation. I mean, if you look at what those conditions are in Gaza, what is slowing down of an operation other, you know, anything other than a full end of the atrocities, a full end of the violence, is a slow strangulation of those people. You're seeing the conditions that people are living under. You're seeing the mass starvation, the mass dehydration campaigns that are being undergone. I don't know. It's a pretty nasty thing to sit around and be like, oh, well, you know, slow death by starvation. Is a solution to anything. It's truly, truly disgusting language that we've gotten from defenders of the Biden administration, defenders of the Israeli government here. And it's that video, you know, really, I think, makes clear these are people in some of the most desperate conditions, not just in the world today, but in history.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's move a little bit onto the South Africa part of this. This next video was going around TikTok. Actually, I saw it shared by Zionist, mocking the idea of apartheid. And again, apartheid is not the term at issue here. But I seeing this video, it makes me depressed, honestly, because this represents what is depicted in the video. These young Israeli women is a failure of a humanistic project that I want to see in the world, right? Like these women are so poisoned from humanity. So to give you what I'm saying, they're mocking the idea that Israel is labeled an apartheid society by taking videos of themselves pointing to things that aren't Jewish and saying there's apartheid. And I slowed down one of those because you can kind of see, well.
Tel Aviv. At the apartheid. This is the apartheid. Look, guys, it's the apartheid. It's the apartheid.
The apartheid. So, all right, I play that one slow because she doesn't even finish the word before she's ashamed and pulls up short in front of these people.
Yeah.
And I just think of, like, what kind of way is this to go through, like, existence? And here is just an article from Haaretz today. And I'll play a little bit of the, so people can hear. Education Ministry withdraws funding of Jewish event over Arab-Israeli host. A woman who represents mixed marriage cannot represent Jewish culture. So the ministry about journalist and host Lucy Aharish, who is married to Jewish Fada star. Basically, there's a mixed marriage and it's too much for this Israeli council, and they pulled funding. The idea that you would, you know, grow up, and I mean, it's just like, it's mm-hmm. it's a structure that fundamentally produces broken people, which is what those young women are. And to go up and the fun of it, the thing is they know it fundamentally when she says, and she, like stops and she, there's the apartheid, and she's worried that the, Palestinian woman is going to hear them. I don't know if they're in Tel Aviv, maybe, or was it that was in Tel Aviv, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is worried that she's going to be overheard, saying there's the, like, you're using these people as props for propaganda, literally. And you know that it's wrong and you still do it. I mean, it's crazy.
No, just because you don't even have the courage to finish your sentence in front of the person.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You don't even have the temerity to continue your nasty campaign there.
You know it's not true. I mean, and you're still doing bits about it. That's mind control. Like that is crazy. So just to do a trip down memory lane here, here's a little bit of footage of South Africa in years past, and how I'd say honestly, the thing about South Africa, if they were going to get apartheid South Africa, if they were going to give modern Israel notes, is don't be so defensive. Okay. Mm-hmm. Just do it. Just act like everything's cool like this.
Country of people, Africans, black and white, Asian and color, rich and poor, young and old. This is our South Africa.
No.
Now, left reckoners who watch a lot of our programming will be familiar with this clip, but this is from a documentary from a
believer. Wait, just really quick on that last video. Yeah. Let's just be very clear, especially for people who might have been watching something like that. That's an old apartheid kind of propaganda video saying that there's no apartheid in South Africa. Because look, there are black people at the beach or on camera walking around town, right? It is the exact same kind of mentality. It's the exact same kind of sloppy defense as you're seeing today. And it's so striking to actually see those things put back to back. Because it's the exact same argument, it's the exact same playbook, it's the exact same attempt to sort of paint a picture that even the people in Israel know is a lie when they're trying to record those videos today, just like they knew it was a lie back then in South Africa.
Yeah, exactly. And so this next clip here, I think, is one of the more interesting bits I've ever come across, because it shows a consciousness of, you know, talk about terms being important. Settler colonial is why these two countries are linked, Israel and South Africa. And the dialectic that this guy has gone through here is one that Israel has also, the Zionists that think that, okay, we're going to expel more Palestinians from Gaza, for instance, and maybe even further our grasp on the West Bank. They've gone through this as well. And also they have the benefit of seeing South Africa losing their apartheid status. And like the concern here, I think, that is the world is going to need to force Israel to not benefit from those lessons to maintain it. So anyway, this guy puts it, I think, very succinctly, that it's going to take a little bit of force.
If there is not the strength of will on the part of the Afrikaner to follow the course he's chosen and to do it to a certain extent ruthlessly, although I would say he will always try to justify it vis-a-vis certain moral principles. But if this is missing, I mean, we have lost. Then we must capitulate. Then we have no policy.
The Afrikaner is of European stock. Our traditions are European.
And yeah, so I think, like, when this has very little to do like the content of this being like religious or whatever, this being a religious fight. No, this is a settler colonial project, and it has developed like settler colonial projects have in the past. And here are two Afrikaners also talking about why you can't really just do one person, one vote style democracy.
Evolved a different set of traditions to suit our being an African people now. And we differ from the English in small respects, but we differ very greatly from the other peoples who inhabit this country.
Yes, I think that each man has been given his piece of country and the right to vote in his country, and that is fair. Because if you have to put, if we have to say one man, one vote in South Africa and just leave it open, then the white is not going to get a fair share because he has contributed economically to making this country what it is today. And if you say tomorrow, one man, one vote, then he doesn't, there is no chance for him. So it's better that each person be given the chance to have his piece of country and decide how he wants to live and what he wants to do with his country there.
It is tragic and appalling that
So yeah, I think that kind of rings familiar a little bit here. And, you know, we'll get to some of the more, well, Bernie, actually. But I do also want to play this Israeli spokesperson talking with this BBC interviewer who does a better job than you would maybe expect from a BBC person. But and I'm getting a little bit of echo from you, David, so I'm going to mute you. There you go. I think Derek Davison mentioned this on the American Prestige podcast, but they're simultaneously trying to argue that they're being very careful in their selection of targets and that they don't consider all Gazans to be their enemy, only Hamas. And they're also saying that the people who are trying to represent Palestinians and Gazans are Hamas. And that's what this guy does here on BBC.
Has decided to play advocate for the devil and serve as the legal arm of Hamas.
I'm going to pause you there, if I may, Mr. Levy, because almost every point I put to you or every question I ask you, you respond with an answer that is not relevant to the question.
Well, let me answer directly then. The
Please.
Lawyer there who is serving as the legal representative of Hamas, accusing Israel of genocide, is presenting a topsy-turvy reality in which Hamas does not exist, it hasn't taken hostages, Israel decided one bright morning to start bombing Gaza. On October 7th, we suffered an act of genocide. We suffered an act of genocide when Hamas invaded our country and boned, beheaded, tortured, mutilated, raped, and abducted as many people as it could, as brutally as it could. And in response, we have launched a defensive campaign with very clear objectives: to destroy the Hamas regime so that it cannot hurt our people again, and to bring back the hostages who are still trapped in the terror dungeons. Those goals are very clear, and we have been pursuing them in full accordance with international law.
And that is disputed. I want to ask you about these comments made by Israeli politicians since October the 7th, and hopefully we can bring up the quotes. Here we are. This is your president. It's an entire nation out there that's responsible. He's referring to Gazans. Have a look at this. The next one. We are now actually rolling out the Gaza Nakba. Nakba, as people know, is a term for catastrophe after the 1948 war, a war used by Palestinians about ethnic cleansing. And we all have one common goal, erasing the Gaza Strip from the face of the earth. Can you see why some people believe that you absolutely don't want Palestinians any longer in Gaza?
We think we have been very clear, both in word and in deed.
In those words?
Well, Mr. Vettori does not make decisions on security matters in Israel. We think we've been very clear, both in word and in deed, that the people of Gaza are not our enemy. Our enemy is the Hamas regime.
And so when that Afrikaner guy says, look, of course we're going to try to rationalize it, but ultimately we have to follow the course of action that we decided on. And so that guy says, oh, that guy doesn't make decisions. Never mind that one of the people was the fucking president, Isaac Herzog. And it's just like, can our systems, our media, and our international law, can it deal with motivated lying that also will kill as part of its project? Can it stand up to that? Is the question, you know, we have to wait and see.
Yeah. I mean, I think you put it well there. And as you're sort of putting out, there's like the entire rationale of like the Southern Colonial Project is like doing something that most people, I think, inherently know is wrong. And that's why not only do you sort of, you know, engage in mass propaganda campaigns, massive lying campaigns, but also in the kind of threats that people on the Israeli left have to deal with on a regular basis. As we're talking about that young man who refused to serve in the IDF. You know, this is somebody who not only, you know, is taking a brave stance and doing something just saying, I'm not going to participate in these attacks, but somebody who is now going to face for the rest of their life, as long as the system maintains itself, right? Persecution and attacks for the decisions that they made. They're not the only one who's ever done this. You know, this is something that has happened to other, you know, Israelis who have refused to participate in this project. But this is how these kind of systems maintain themselves, right? One, through the kind of direct aspect of propaganda, and then through like the actual punishment, humiliation, attacks on people's livelihood, abilities to get employment, further their own personal life. You know, this is all to maintain a system that I think deep down most people know is unjust. And just lastly too, just, you know, going back to the one person, one vote. I mean, this is exactly the kind of two-faced discussion that we get all the time about, you know, potential solutions here. Where, you know, one thing about Palestinians that I think is really important to note is that on top of like the actual like slaughter campaigns against them, the lack of ability for Palestinians to be able to pursue and have a state. It's also the separation of Palestinians. Palestinians who live in Israel, Palestinians who live in Gaza, Palestinians who live in the West Bank. Having all these people under different systems is all meant to dilute the Palestinian population, right? And, you know, this is just textbook apartheid. This is textbook attempts to try to marginalize, defeat, and push out a whole group of people. Yeah. Well, we're going to go to the interview in just a second, but before we do that, we did want to do a quick shout out. And this is somebody who, you know, we haven't had too many good things to say, frankly, since the beginning of this conflict. But this is something that is notable and I think is very important, which is that, Bernie Sanders is pushing, right now, I believe, right, Matt? A vote in the Senate, to force, a vote that would potentially freeze American military aid to Israel. It would make the United States State Department have to investigate claims of war crimes and crimes against humanity by Israel. And if they fail to produce a report, it would mean that American aid would be frozen. Very unlikely to get through. Let's just be honest about that. Very unlikely to get through with the state of the Democratic Party in this country. Very unlikely to get through with the leadership in the Democratic Party we've been getting from Joe Biden. But again, a very damn important thing. And here's Bernie Sanders speaking with Jake Tapper just the other day about this.
The spokesman for the National Security Council, John Kirby, responded to your plan saying, quote, "We do not believe that this resolution is the right vehicle to address these issues. And we don't think now is the right time. The Israelis have indicated they are preparing to transition their operations to a much lower intensity. And we believe that that transition will be helpful both in terms of reducing civilian casualties as well as increasing humanitarian assistance," unquote. What do you say to that?
I strongly disagree. Jake, we have got to, as Americans, take a very deep breath. What is going on in Gaza right now is a horrendous humanitarian catastrophe. We're looking at 23,000 people who have been killed, almost 60,000 have been wounded, and two-thirds of the people who have been killed are women and children. You're looking at 70% of the housing units in Gaza that have been destroyed. Jake, if I use the word Dresden, Germany to you, you think about the horrific destruction during World War II of that city. What is going on in Gaza now in 3 months is worse than what took place in Dresden over a two-year period. This is a catastrophe. And now, according to the United Nations, after you have 1.9 million people displaced from their homes, they don't have food, they don't have water, they don't have medical equipment, they don't have fuel. What you are looking at is imminent starvation. Children are starving to death. So my view has been from the beginning, Israel has a right to respond to this horrific terrorist attack from Hamas. But you do not have a right to go to war against an entire people, women and children. And the United States Congress has got to act, because a lot of this destruction is being done with military weapons supplied by the United States of America. And what the resolution that I'm introducing is about, it's consistent with the Foreign Assistance Act. It says that if American military assistance is given to any country, Saudi Arabia, Israel, any other country, it has got to be used consistent with human rights, international human rights standards, and American law. In my opinion, that is certainly not the case. We have a horrific humanitarian catastrophe. We cannot turn our backs on it. Congress has got to stop moving to protect children in Palestine.
Yeah. So, you know.
You know, I mean, this is not, I think there might be an impression that Bernie, people who have followed the online stuff might have the impression that this is a change of pace for Bernie. Bernie has been doing this, I think, more or less from the beginning. Mm-hmm. He just won't say the word ceasefire. And I think that's pretty consistent with how we've been understanding Bernie, which is that probably around when he stopped his campaign in 2020, Bernie has basically dropped the mantle of movement leader. Mm-hmm. And he is now what is, you know, in a vacuum, very welcome, a way above average power broker in the Senate, including on this issue, even though I think, you know, he's not great. He's not where I would want to see a politician, right? He can play that role of above average power broker in the Senate. Again, the Senate is an institution we're not necessarily a fan of. So it's like, that is a low bar. This stuff is helpful. I welcome this and, you know, I appreciate it. It's unhelpful when he undermines the broader global left pro-Palestine movement calling for a ceasefire. That is objectively mm-hmm. not helpful. And why we're running that sort of cross purpose isn't entirely clear to me. But nonetheless, this sort of thing where the government has a extra, I mean, not that we like seriously vet the Saudis either, I imagine, but this has been known for a while now. Whistleblowers have come out and said like they raise concerns and they're told by higher ups, often like the type of people put in place by either the Trump administration or Biden administration, that's Israel. We're slow walk that. Keep that on your desk, but you know, not really priority right now or early ever. And that is, again, like that the world sees that. This isn't like some secret history. The only people this is a secret to is really our electorate, and maybe the electorate of Europe and Israel. But like this is known that we don't take this shit seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I think you just said it well, so I'm not going to relitigate anything, but I will just say that like, one of the things is like, I think it is important to be able to kind of criticize from a place of understanding. Let me rephrase that, because I don't want people to say criticize from a place of like sympathy. I just mean it's like sometimes like the online left discussions sort of are going to miss, for example, that, you know, Bernie Sanders has been pushing something like this. And this is not like a defense or an absolution of all the things that we've been really frustrated with. But it just is maybe a kind of nudge to kind of root our criticism in what's actually going on and seeing what's happening, both good and bad. Well, folks, unless you had anything else to add to that, Matt, I think we're going to jump over to our conversation with Marianne Williamson, who's running for the Democratic Party nomination for President of the United States. It was really interesting being able to speak with her. We'll play that interview. And then right after that, Matt and I are going to go over to the postgame, patreon.com/leftreckon, to get access to that. And you'll hear Matt and I's thoughts on what was said in that interview. And we might talk a little bit about Iowa, take some calls and questions from the listeners. So you won't want to miss all of that. But without further ado, we have our conversation here with Marianne Williamson.
And
welcome back, Left Reckoners. David here, and I'm very thrilled to be joined by Marianne Williamson, who is seeking the Democratic Party nomination for president, and is also, it's important to note, a fellow Texan. Marianne, thank you so much for joining us today on Left Reckoners.
Thank you. Where do you come from in Texas?
I'm from Austin.
I'm from Houston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I wanted to talk to you about a few things, and I'm really happy that you're able to take some time and join us today. But before we jump into talking about, you know, your platform, I want to talk a little bit about the state of the primary in the Democratic Party, because I'd be very curious to hear your experience running within the Democratic primary, because from the outside looking in, I have to say that it feels like the Democratic Party isn't taking very seriously their commitment to cultivating internal democracy right now, which is very frightening when we see these threats on democracy coming from the right wing. But I was just curious if you could tell us a little bit about your experience.
What you just said is 100% true. You don't suppress democracy in order to save democracy. We've seen this before. We saw what they did to Bernie in 2016. We saw what happened in 2020. And now they're not even covert about it on any level. There is no special assignation given in the United States Constitution to incumbency. People primary senators, sitting senators all the time, people primary sitting congresspeople all the time as part of the practice of democracy. When I was a young, actually a teenager, Eugene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy Sr. primaried Lyndon Johnson. He was an incumbent. Nobody thought it was weird. We thought it was democracy. And by the way, I want to say something else. It was also very important because that led to the end of the Vietnam War. So somebody coming in and saying, no, I don't care if he's an incumbent. What he's doing is not what is needed here. That's what democracy does. I think that the Democratic Party, weirdly, unlike the Republican Party, has given all this power to the GNC. We're in so many traditional Democrats are kind of in a codependent relationship. Well, the GNC says, who the hell is that? You know, Washington, in his farewell address, warned us about political parties. He said that it would form factions of men who were more loyal to their party than to their country. John Adams said he saw them as a threat to democracy. Traditionally and appropriately, the political party stands in the back. It's the people. Hello, we the people who decide who the nominee is. And at that point, the party is supposed to come forward. Here, they said from the beginning, we see our job as making sure Joe Biden gets the nomination and then the presidency. I remember very shortly after I announced, I was watching, I don't know if it was CNN or MSNBC, and there was a panel, and my name came up about my running, and there was a young woman who was clearly miffed. How dare I, right? And the comment.
Well, you know, I did lose you a little bit here.
Are you there? Are you there now?
I'm sorry, Marina. Yeah, we missed you a little bit there. You were saying that right after you announced, there was a panel on MSNBC.
Right. And on this panel, there was a young woman. And when my name came up and she was asked, she was clearly miffed. Like, who let you in here? You know, I want to say James Madison, a little help from Susan B. Anthony, or whatever. She was clearly miffed. And then she said something. She said, well, I think this is what we should do. We should just ignore her. Let's just pretend she's not here. Now, when she said that, my thought was, well, good luck with that. But that's exactly their playbook. They have sought to invisibilize, to smear, to erase. And now what has happened in this latest phase, because they have shown they are vicious. They will do whatever it takes to get you out of the conversation if you do not toe their corporate line. If you suggest that you want to overturn that corporate apple cart, they're coming after you. To the point where now they're knocking me and my fellow candidate, Dean Phillips, just off. Ballots. Nope, you're not on the ballot in Florida. Nope, you're not on the ballot in Tennessee. Nope, you're not on the ballot in North Carolina. Nope, you're not on the ballot in Wisconsin. The secretaries of state say, well, you know, the DNC says.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I wanted to ask you, you know, what would your response be to somebody who does make the argument that, you know, Donald Trump represents such a threat to American democracy? That regardless of the criticisms we might have of somebody like Joe Biden, it's important to have him go into the campaigns, into the general election unscathed, uncriticized, because, you know, anything that is sort of critical about Joe Biden might sort of open up opportunities for Donald Trump. How would you respond to somebody who makes that argument to you?
My response is that it is because Donald Trump is such a threat It is because the fascists are at the door that we should be having a robust conversation about who would be the best candidate to oppose him in the 2024 election. This idea that it is by definition Joe Biden, I submit that maybe we should discuss that. He is shrinking in the, his poll numbers are shrinking. He is unpopular with a lot of different groups for a lot of different reasons. The idea that because he beat him last time, he'll beat him this time, there's no logic there. That's like saying, number one, to an actor who won the Oscar last year, well, you won last year, of course you won this year. It's a different movie. This is not going to be like 2020. This is going to be much like 2016. So this idea that we're supposed to just fall in line with, because Trump is a threat, it should be Joe Biden and we should all get behind Joe Biden. I say, because Trump is such a threat, we need to get behind someone else. We need to get behind someone specifically who represents a better deal for the American people, an economic U-turn. That's how we are going to win in 2024. First of all, they tried with Bidenomics. Well, good luck with that, guys, because that only applies to 20% of Americans who's for whom economically things are good. That's number one. So then they shifted to be afraid, be very, very afraid. Once again, this is not like 2020. The electoral risk for the Democrats in 2024 is not Donald Trump. The electoral risk is people staying home. People who feel no particular sense that Joe Biden will change their lives or the issues that they care about in any appreciable way. So it's because the fascists are at the door that I hope people will go to Marianne2024.com. Look at my agenda. You know, this is the thing. The majority of Republicans, not as big a majority as the Democrats, but a majority want universal health care. A majority of Republicans, as well as Democrats, not as big a majority, but still a majority, want tuition-free college and tech school. We have 39% of the American people who now say they regularly skip meals to pay for their rent. The majority work paycheck to paycheck. The majority cannot absorb a $500 unexpected expenditure. That's why I'm the far better candidate, because I say to the American people, we can do better. We can have an economic bill of rights. We can have a Department of Peace. We can end America's drug war. We can have a mass mobilization for a just transition from a dirty economy to a clean economy, inspiring people to something much, much better, to something new, to a new beginning. That's how we're going to beat Donald Trump. He pulls people down. We need to pull people up. And that would be with an agenda of hope and possibility. And I believe that that's what the progressive agenda is.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, I will say these past 4 years under Biden have been fairly difficult. And there's been a lot of gaslighting about like the state of the American economy, what this has meant for workers.
And the environment.
One silver lining has been things and the environment. Absolutely. But one silver lining has been things like the UAW coming up against the big three and winning that strike. I'm curious, you know, if you could make, you know, your pitch, how would a Marianne Williamson administration help bolster and further the gains that we've seen over the past couple of years in the union movement?
Well, that wasn't Joe Biden. That was Sean Fain. You know what I mean? I'm sorry. You know, when you see what Christian Smalls has done, what the kids at Barista's, you know, at Starbucks has done, Sean Fain, what's going on with the Teamsters and UPS? I'm sorry. I don't give you know, the credit there to Joe Biden. He says he's a labor president. Certainly, he's not an active union buster the way Nikki Haley, for instance, in South Carolina has been. Although, you know, I don't think his behavior with the railroad strike is anything for anybody pro-labor to be excited about. He has not mentioned the PRO Act once he got in. I haven't heard any further mention of the PRO Act. No real capital spent on it. You do have a friendlier National Labor Relations Board than we had certainly under Trump, but it needs to be more robust. It needs to be funded much better. So to say that this is an example of one of many areas where, is he better than the Republicans? Absolutely. But that's such a low bar. So the gains of the, you know, I would have been on the picket line if they wanted me there. You know, I would have been on the picket line.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, on that, I mean, one thing that we cover a lot on this program, particularly being based here in Texas, is this question of what a just transition would look like. You know, the question around a just transition and getting off of dirty fossil fuels is a two-part question. One is like, how do we build the infrastructure of green renewable energy? But two, how do we do it in a way where people working in those industries aren't going to working in conditions where they have bad jobs, non-union jobs? And it's something that I found a lot of people in the Democratic Party aren't really interested in having that second level conversation about what does a transition actually mean for people who work in the energy industry today? And I was curious what your thoughts are on that.
And you're right. It's very arrogant and elitist for Democrats to act like that's not an issue. It's very much an issue. We'll take that one first. You know, one man came up to me. He said, I make over $100,000 working for the oil company. What do you want me to do, Ms. Williamson? Work for, what, $14 an hour installing solar panels? This man has a right to ask that question. But let's be very clear here. Technology, manufacturing, and research, a lot of those jobs are lateral. A lot of those jobs can be lateral. Now, if things are done well and the president creates a positive enough relationship with these oil companies, a lot of this is not leaving these guys behind, but getting these guys to repurpose. They can take some of their own employees. And, you know, you were doing this with your technological skill last week. You're going to do that with your technological skill this week. And those people, and that is the meaning of the just transition, those people should not fall through the cracks. And in a Williamson administration, they will not fall through the cracks. They are given top priority at those jobs. You know, whether you're working on oil or you're working on development of clean energy, when it comes to manufacturing, when it comes to engineering, when it comes to technology, a lot of those skill sets are very much the same, and it needs to be strategized. And I'm not only aware of the issue, I think of the moral commitment that the country has to make to those, as you said, thousands of people, once again, and a lot of them are in Texas, absolutely. Secondly, in terms of how we do it, it's how you spend your money. It's where you put your resources, where you put your funding, where you put your subsidies. We haven't, you know, there's a lot of growth going on in a green energy grid now, but not nearly the level. It needs to be a World War II level mass mobilization.
Well, I mean, on that question, would you prefer building out publicly owned utilities versus sort of encouraging the private market to do that more in the style of like the TVA
expansion? Let's start with public-private partnerships. Let's not, you know, I don't want to be a bomb thrower. I don't want to be a chaos agent. We're going to make some fundamental shifts here. And if we go in and you just like throw everything up in the air, you know, let's be smart here. One of my favorite stories is what happened when President Roosevelt knew, given what Hitler was doing, we're going to have to get in. We didn't have an army to speak of, and Britain had nothing. So he needed this many ships and this many planes and this many tanks. So where is he going to get it? Well, he's going to get it from the industrial powers of the Midwest. No different. The same big three is represented there today. And in our cases, you know, energy companies and to a great extent. So he calls those guys into the Oval Office and he says, gentlemen, I need this many tanks and this many ships and this many planes. And they say to him, Mr. President, we're patriotic Americans and we support you. And as soon as we finish selling these cars, we will give you your ships and your planes and your trains and your tanks. Roosevelt responded, gentlemen, I don't think you quite understand what I'm saying to you. It is a national emergency. We need this many ships, this many tanks, and this many planes, and you won't be selling cars until I get them. Now, he knew he was going to have to build a partnership with them because they were going to make a profit ultimately. But he did it. He forged a partnership, but he made it very clear. First, the war effort. And that's what we need to start with, a president who makes it clear. This is an emergency. It is a national emergency. It is a global emergency. And I'm not asking you to play ball. I'm telling you, I am assuming the powers of the presidency, even if that means declaring a climate emergency. This will come first. The ability of our great-grandchildren to breathe comes before your profits. Now let's talk.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's very interesting. And I just I need to ask though before we conclude here, because it's I think one of the biggest issues going into the 2024 election, particularly around Joe Biden, is like the mass slaughter campaign in Gaza. And I'm curious if first up, if you could sort of categorize your thoughts on how Biden has been leading or not leading in this moment, and what you might be doing differently if you were sitting in the Oval Office today.
Well, October 7th, he had a lot of moral clarity that I appreciated. When it has come to the bombardment of Gaza, he has lacked moral clarity. The death of a Palestinian child is no less horrifying than the death of an Israeli child. So I do not understand, you say support Israel. There are different ways you support Israel. Supporting them militarily at this point in this war, it transgresses our own values. Support for a friend should not mean the sacrifice of your own moral values. And so our highest allegiance should be with humanity itself. I would not be supporting this at all, and I would be making it clear. Now, what we hear,
Would you stand with South Africa in their investigation of Israel for genocide?
Well, we're not even part of the criminal court. So the South Africa has brought the case. It is being argued. And by the way, I think we should be, don't get me wrong. But they probably haul away Dick Cheney and we know it, right? So that case is being argued right now. And it will be a very, very, very interesting to see where it goes. I understand the argument that both people are making, but ultimately the word is not what matters. The death of those people is what matters. Whether you call it genocide or you don't call it genocide, it is the indiscriminate bombing of civilians. It is not okay. So as far as the American president is concerned, whether they call it genocide or not, I mean, people are acting these days like words matter more than the reality, and more importantly, more than what it will take to actually change the reality. And that's what I'm interested in, and that's what I would be interested in.
Changing that reality.
And changing that reality, exactly. So President Biden had a phone call with Netanyahu, who I believe is a villain in this situation. He had a call with Netanyahu, apparently trying to pressure him. Okay, speed this up. You don't say to somebody, speed up. You say, stop. Mm-hmm. Stop. And then apparently Biden was not pleased with it. He said, this phone call is over. But the money and the military assistance are still there. And I would be using all my power to stop it. We need a release of the hostages. We need an immediate ceasefire, not later, now. And we need architecture for a two-state solution. And that is what the United States should be passionately supporting.
Well, Marianne, I really appreciate you taking some time to join us on Left Reckoning. Could you tell people where they might be able to learn more about your campaign?
Thank you. Marianne2024.com. And I hope that you will look very closely at the issues pages. Everything from the drug policy to the health policy to the economic policies to the immigration policies to the climate policies to Department of Peace, Economic Bill of Rights, ending America's war on drugs. It's a real economic U-turn. It's the creation of a new chapter of American history. It is cutting the cord with the aberrational chapter of neoliberal economics. It's not going to happen unless we, the people, intervene. If we continue to vote for Biden or Trump, Biden's better, but that's a really low, low bar. It's incremental change. And if you're feeling, well, I'm going to vote for Cornell, or I'm going to vote for Bobby, or I'm going to vote for Claudia, or I'm going to vote, or Jill. That's cool. You still have a lot of time to think about that. But I hope that you will consider voting for me in the primary. And there should be a candidate in the primary who stands on the issue of Gaza, as on the issue of everything else, for something very different than what this president is offering. So thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well done, David.
All right, friends. Matt and I definitely have some thoughts on that. and we'll tease them. You got to join us over there at patreon.com/leftreckoning. Join us in the post game to hear those. We'll also be taking calls and questions from all of y'all. So if you have anything on your mind, come join us on the other side and we'll chat about them for a little bit. So we'll be up in about 10, 15 minutes, folks. Appreciate everybody for hanging out with us on Left Reckoning 153. Really quick, we got some cool guests coming on the program soon. We got Ben Fong, who has an excellent new podcast out with Jacobin. We'll be interviewing him soon. Y'all should be listening to it already. It's a really incredible breakdown of labor history in this country, which I'm really excited to talk more about that. Got a few more people cooking up. A lot of good things coming up in this month of January. So,
going to be some more Israel-Palestine. Maybe we'll talk some Yemen. And yeah, I'm going to get going to be covering the story of the time a little bit more in depth. And also, David, you did something with our store that I wanted to remind you about.
If you want to get your Left Reckoning merch, this is the best time to do it. For the next 2 weeks, we're going to be doing free shipping on all of our merch on leftreckoning.com/store. You can get that with the code RIDEON, RIDEON. RIDEON, you get free shipping. You can get the Left Reckoning cap. You can get the Fence Cutters sweatshirt. Our Big Tex tank and our Great Plains t-shirt. So please consider doing that. It really does help us continue to grow and expand.
My girlfriend just told me not an hour ago when we were playing the Marianne interview, you look good in that hat.
And, dude, I've been hearing it more and more.
I wear a lot of hats.
I'll tell you, it's on my desk too. I was wearing it before I came in to do this. It's a great hat. So you definitely want to grab that. And also I will say to our international listeners, if you really do want one, we would love to find a way to get you to do it. I just can't have it set up on our website. So if you send us an email at leftreckoning@gmail.com with your address and what it is that you want, I can give you a quote to see if we can get it over to you. And, international shipping is expensive. So that's the reason that we can't put it up on the store because it's a little bit case by case basis. But love to help you all out. Appreciate all of y'all so much. Come join us in the postgame, patreon.com/leftreckoning. It was really interesting talking to Marianne. So we'll have some thoughts on that, hear your questions and calls, and hang out a little bit. So come by.
See you, folks.